So it's nice to be back after a week away teaching at IMS. Believe me, you would prefer this weather to that weather. So we are continuing the exploration of the third foundation of the Satipatthana Sutta, and what we have been doing so far is looking at states of mind that have the compelling conditioning to divide us out, to separate us, to create a division, a schism between ourselves. And it's important for us to understand that at the basis of what we were speaking about, the mind is a single thing. It's a whole. And it's only when one image is pitted against an idea or an experience that there's a sense that two things are arising, myself and the experience I'm having. And so we're looking at ways that very difficult and compelling states of mind create a sense of that division, that divisiveness. And so tonight I want to talk about division through doubt. And we've looked at several states of mind. We've looked at desire, and we've looked at aversion, we've looked at fear. We will look at doubt tonight, and we'll look at a few other states of mind as the third foundation is explored. One is that you're not going to feel completely satisfied after a couple of weeks on a subject. And what I would suggest is to go to either our website or another website if you need more information on a particular state of mind, and stay with it until it feels like you've reached the satiation point and understand basically what the message is and how to work with that state. So we're just touching in on different states now, and perhaps, well, at another time we will explore each of these states, but not in this series. So tonight we're going to just touch around doubt. And doubt, just to get a sense of our cultural, the persuasion it has within this culture, because it feeds on a kind of collective unworthiness that this culture is very induced with very strongly, both because of the economics of how this culture is driven economically. And within that, there's a kind of tension of comparison and evaluation that we give one another through the competitive nature of trying to acquire more and more when there's a limited amount of resources. And that sense of individuation of the wanting that is being induced within us through advertisement, etc. You can't possibly obtain everything you want. Can't possibly obtain what your neighbor has even. And so inevitably within that fallout of that, there is a sense of you being a failure, us being a failure. And you don't realize how we've been inducted into that since we were born in this culture. So the culture is what it is. We have to work with it, but we have to know what the conditioning aspects are within us, and doubt is certainly one of those. So I just want us to get a sense of this thing called doubt. Self-doubt is really what I'm going to be addressing, and how, I mean, there may be someone out there that doesn't have it, but I haven't met them yet. It's almost universal. And so we don't want to pretend that we don't have it, and we want to look at it shining the light of truth upon it. That is the way we can uproot it. It doesn't uproot itself by reacting from it or trying to compensate for it. As any pattern, we know that that's just an unconscious reaction to the pain the pattern holds about us. And when we act from that pain, we will inevitably recondition, further condition that pattern within us. So it really requires a sobriety and a maturity from you. First, to acknowledge that you live with self-doubt, and secondly, to be willing to face it. So those are not two small provisions. Those are not two small, those are major maturity, major thresholds that we reach upon maturity, that we even want to acknowledge that we have it, and secondly, that we want to see it for what it is. Now, as we go through this, you see, the other limitation of this culture, and I'm not trashing this culture, all cultures have limitations, but it's important for us to know what those limitations are, not to pretend like we, you know, are the best culture, and all this kind of patriotic fervor doesn't help us. What does help us is for us to see objectively and critically what are the values and limitations of what the influences upon our life. And another tremendous influence upon our life in this culture is that we are a knowledge-based culture, a thought culture. Our cathedrals are our universities, really. And so we place the highest evaluation, the highest value on people who are the most learned, the most book-learned, and the most knowledgeable within subjects. And what that does is that it creates an enormous influence of opinionation. Opinionation, we think somebody's very clear when they have a lot of opinions, because they have thought a lot, and therefore and have a lot of knowledge based upon what they're actually saying. So you can, even as I say that, hopefully you can feel the limitation of that way of being, especially when you're interested in the truth of what's occurring. You can see that opinions, in fact, any knowledge that we have obscures the learning that's necessary to see that truth in innocence. Anything we bring to something is too much, because we can't see it freshly, anew. We see it for what we have known it to be, or what someone has told us about it. And so our opinions and our knowledge is it's influenced in spirituality, actually obstruct a clearer vision. To see clearly is the object of meditation, and we can't see clearly through our past experiences and opinionation. So we have a lot of stuff coming at us from this culture, and just to get a sense, okay, so what do I really want from life? And if I want to be thought of and evaluated in light of this culture, then having a lot of book knowledge is the way to do it. But if I want to be grow spiritually, I have to grow in counter-influence to some of the ways that this culture has inducted us. That's all I'm saying. So to know that and to get a sense of that. So as we have gone through each of these foundations of mindfulness, each of these foundations give you a different aspect of the self to understand, so that we begin to explore and penetrate this seemingly opaque thing called the self. Seems very solid, three-dimensional, and we carry it around all the time. And each of these foundations is meant to give us a platform on which we can ask questions about the self, begin to flesh out the details of what the self really is, begin to take this ball of cotton that is very dense and concentrated, and begin to pull it out so that light comes through it. And none of us, I'm not expecting many of us, perhaps some, to have a full range of understanding of what the self is, but just getting a feeling of how it lands and what it does and how it compels and what its strategies are, et cetera, et cetera. You begin to, just getting a feeling for it, is sufficient, and it will have its own influence upon how the cell forms in the future. But if we're going to just be compelled by the influences of our culture, you're going to find that the self doesn't flush itself out. You aren't going to be wanting to see it. In fact, it's going to be much more dense and condensed through the influences of the culture. It's called the culture works towards individuation, not towards understanding that sense of separation. And so that's why it's so important to take these major conditioning patterns, like doubt, and begin to really explore them with a maturity and a willingness that requires a direct knowledge, not a learned knowledge. A direct knowledge is that knowledge that only comes when we are willing to see, in light of our own truth, what something is in this moment, not listen to someone else and apply their truth to our situation. That keeps us unconscious and within ignorance, and does nothing for our ability to be free of this pattern. We have to see the pattern for ourselves directly and from a fresh and new perspective. Now, when we're looking at a sense of doubt, I would just like to spend a few minutes here speaking about how doubt creates a sense of division in the mind. I mean, what happens there when doubt arises, that all of a sudden we're thrown back upon the stabbing pain of our inadequacy or unworthiness, and very much lost in the suffering of our history, and what happens during that? And I think it's real important, especially in this series, is to really see how these things, it's not all of a sudden that I've just hold the assumption that I'm a failure, or whatever expression or wording the doubt uses, but that this had a sequence to it. A sequence, a conditioned influence. And the first is that at some point, when there's a moment of being challenged, such as a moment in which you don't know something, there's a feeling associated with that. So we go back to the second foundation, and you begin to sense that the second foundation precedes the elaboration of the third foundation, the elaboration of mind. So that sense of feeling of just being challenged, of being, of all of a sudden, almost immediately, comes in a barrage of history about how we are within a challenged situation. And often you will find that you will forget all of the successes you've had in the challenging situation and remember the painful components. So mostly what we pull out from that historical file cabinet of all the challenges we faced, remember we have a billion neurons firing simultaneously here. This is a computer system that has the speed of light, really. And so it's coming in terms of images, carrying images in flashes very, very quickly, bringing forth and each of those flashes having a feeling tone associated with them, all being composed into a central feeling tone that weighs in with what happens? What happens? How does it weigh in? An energetic pullback, a fear of being oneself. Suddenly, it crystallizes all out, all of these flashes of images from neurons firing, and the sense of challenge before us, which is the experience at hand, there is a fear of being oneself within this situation. And that fear of being oneself is it, you feel an energetic pullback it's just like, oh God, I can't do this. And then we will often have a defense against that assumption. We have that assumption, but then we will try to defend that assumption. That assumption being so painful that I can't do this, I will explore what those next strategies are a little later, but there often is a defense to that pain and then an acting out in one way or another in regards to that pain. And so we get stuck between the sense of oneself as I can't, and the continuation of the desire to do. Because if you take like spiritual work, if you want to take the most difficult thing you ever have to do in your life, that's spiritual work. There's nothing you could ever do that would be more difficult than this, because you're turning your life completely 180 degrees around. All the things you've learned, you unlearn. So it's completely walking backward in our terms of influence. And therefore, even being able to condition attention to our breath, you know, you take the hardest things that we face, what do you think is going to arise there? Oh, I can do this. No, not likely. Not if you've been conditioned to think that you can't. What's going to arise is, I can't do this. And so within that moment of being stuck between I can't, and yet there's a continuation probably of an urge just the urge or compelling sense that I want to do it, but I can't do it. So when we're locked in between those two, we become half-hearted. Now, spontaneity requires full-heartedness. That's the definition of spontaneity, is that there's no abbreviation, there's no fraction of you that's separated from the energy of spontaneity. Energy of spontaneity, by definition, requires 100% energy. So this half-heartedness is already a division within ourselves spiritually. And we think, we work it kind of strangely. We say, well, maybe I'll give it a noble effort. But in our minds, we don't really believe we can do it. So we're held within a kind of sense that we can't do it, but we also want to try, so we try half-heartedly. We sit and kind of let our mind just kind of... We don't really bring the focused energy we need to break through the trance of our thinking. We just sit. I mean, we may sit very, very well so that somebody who's sitting behind us says, oh, that's a Buddha. Inside, we're a schmuck. And we just feel that way. We don't know what to do about it, you know? And we don't know, we're afraid to try harder, because what if we tried and then did fail? It would just convince us once more that we were what we thought we were, which was a failure. So it's better not to try, and then we can always say, well, I didn't give it my full effort. That's why I failed, you see? Instead of the fact that this is the greatest trap. I wish I could. It is by far. And this tradition compromises us in terms of how it talks about this tradition in terms of lifetimes and all of that, because we say, well, I can't do it now, but if I have lifetimes, maybe some lifetime I will. So I'll just keep kind of adapting to the foreverness of my lifetimes, and maybe something will come along and convince me, or somehow I will fall down into freedom. That's our logic. And first we have to see the immediacy of freedom, and secondly, and equally as important, we have to be convinced that each of us have the ability to enter that, to abide there. And it's my job to set it up so that you hear those words, and then you have to deal with how you obscure what you place between yourself and those words. You have to deal with that. I can't deal with that. You have to. But doubt will surely be one of them if you have lived for any length of time within this culture. And so, okay, so what happens then is that the only thing we have that can keep us going, moving forward, is our intention. is the consolidation of that energy. And all of a sudden, our energy is being fractioned. And so we don't have the intention which drives the whole of the practice. It falters. With faltered intention comes faltered view. You hold two different intentions now. One is to save yourself from the pain of the assumptions of your inadequacy, and secondly, your second intention, half-hearted, is to do the meditation and provide some relief to the yearning of your heart. Now you have two pictures in front of you, saving yourself and ending yourself. And believe me, ending yourself can't be compromised. You can't have a multi-screened approach to this. This is not multitasking. This takes everything from you. Okay, so fair enough. Now, when we feel doubt, one of two strategies often arise with a strong sense of insufficiency. Let me just talk about those strategies and you see if you can get a sense of which one of those strategies compels you. One of them is self-insulation, and that's where we try to overcompensate for the pain of the belief that we are inadequate or that we are doubting, and that creates anger and sort of a thrashing out and a sense that it's all about you where there's a desperate fear of the doubt itself, and the cause of the inadequacy is that person, that place, that thing, that event, external blame, anything but having to settle with the fact that the suffering is coming from your own assumption about yourself. So there's this what I call a self-insulation, where the self is insulating itself from feeling the pain by projecting the pain out and thrashing around and pointing fingers. That should sound familiar to many of us. The other, equally as destructive strategy, is self-recrimination. In self-recrimination, it's all about me. In the self-insulation, it was all about you. But now this is all about me. And it feels like a crushing sense of self-failure. And many of us have that. Many of us have that. And you can live your whole life with that. And egoically, your separation will be maintained. And you'll just be miserable in maintaining it. And you will hurt most of the time, quite likely with accompanying emotions that correspond to that hurt, like depression and despair. And so this sense of doubt, we can see it may well have been driving us attitudinally for our entire life. We don't really know how to get in there on it. We go to therapists, but oftentimes our relationship with a therapist is that, my God, there's somebody that's just willing to look at me. That's good enough. I'll pay my money just to have somebody sit there for an hour paid who will accept me and pay attention to me for an hour. Right? Not really do the difficult work necessary under that attention. But just to have someone accompany oneself a little bit in terms of paying attention. So it takes more than that. I just want to encourage us. I know it's very delicate. This is a very delicate subject. I know that almost everyone in the room has some of that. And I know that we've spent our lifetime trying to avoid it and get out of it. And the question I would ask is, has that avoidance or have those strategies worked for you? And if they haven't, then let's see if we can't find something that does work, because there is something that works. I wouldn't stand here and be saying this. if I was just going to lead you like the Pied Piper into some kind of further difficulty and onslaught and further conditioning, I have no interest in creating more pain for you. But there is a way out. There is a way through this. And sometimes you have to go through the fire in order for it to have, like the logs, you know, for the space to be seen between the logs in the poem I read. And so, the most famous case of doubt was the Buddha. Okay, so what did he do when he was doubting? He didn't try self-insulation, which was blame it on Mara or whoever, or he didn't try self-recrimination, like, oh, I'm a terrible person for having this. He just simply touched the ground. And I wish I could convey the strength of that moment of contact, because what he does is aligns his body with the earth in the moment of that touching. Very much like the Sistine Chapel, although the skies, some Godhead is touched, it's the same thing. There's a moment in which the energy is absolutely aligned. And the certainty comes from knowing that one cannot be anywhere else. This is wisdom, that the sense of individual control has always been faulty at best, and that this is where I am, period. There isn't any other possible place I could be in this moment. And therefore, your doubt, which says just the opposite, you should be anywhere but here, this moment of touching the earth concludes without apology, no apology, no excuses here, just the link up between the alignment of energy, earth and body, like tree and body. You think that tree should be somewhere else? Because we have legs, we think, well, I could be somewhere else if I just did move somewhere. No, that's a complete misunderstanding of this moment. You could not be anywhere else. Now, if you really knew that, and you didn't have a faltering perspective of yourself as you touched the earth, that is, you weren't looking around furtively from paranoia that somebody would be finding out and incriminating you about all the things you've done, or all the lack of forgiveness you've had, which keeps us wobbling. If all of a sudden we just opened up to the clarity of that moment of contact, suddenly doubt would be gone immediately. Now, most of us don't have, we don't have access to that single moment of touching. So we're going to bring some other things here that can be helpful in getting to that certainty. But one of the, I don't know how many of you read The Life of Pi by Jan Martel. Anyway, one in there, he says, to choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. And I sort of like that, because it's very much when you begin to sense that, you know, this isn't going to move. We have to take this thing on. And what happens when we falter within our doubt is that we then move with a sense of belief. We move in with the assumptions that we have believed about ourselves. And because doubt, with our doubting, it doesn't provide any kind of certainty, because we haven't learned at this point to have a direct experience, a direct knowledge through our experience. We're just basing who we are on the beliefs we hold of ourselves, or of Buddhism, or whatever. And so when we touch something like a religion, we grasp it. Our doubt wants some assurance of something. And so it grasps at, like Buddhism or Christianity. And depending upon the level of severity of your doubt will be the strength of the grasping. And if your doubt is very strong, you're going to be fundamental in your grasping. And you're going to start proselytizing, because the more people that you can convince that you're right and have them on your side, the less you have to listen to your own doubt and your own discouragement. But if there's one person, maybe 200 people here, if there's one person that doubts, that person becomes your enemy. Oh, maybe 199 people, but that one person accesses the sense in ourselves that we're wrong, accesses the doubt part of ourself. So it has to be 100%, you see. That's why proselytizing cannot stand an alternative position. They have found that somebody who has a strong belief in religion, if you put them in an MRI machine, what lights up is the same area of the brain as somebody who is addicted, an addiction. Because both of those are really attempts to satisfy a kind of craving in ourselves to get out of the misery we feel. So Buddhism isn't about that. I hope people really understand this. It's really not about that. If we're coming to Buddhism because we think it can somehow provide us some sort of belief system that will allow us to be safe from the pain we feel, well, it's not that at all. We come here to see whether the Buddha's words are true. Now, I don't know until I go in there and look from my own experience to see whether they are true. We're not forming a new belief system so that we can go out and proselytize Buddhism. That's why Buddhism, when it's really understood, is not even a religion at all. It's not a belief system. So what probably brings most of you here is the possibility of having the true light of your own understanding provide the guidance for the next step you need to take. In fact, when I'm in interviews, almost the only thing I really do in interviews is to steer the people back to what they already know, to steer them in their own intuitive direction. But the questions I get are often from a sense of self-inadequacy. Should I do this or should I do that? As if, how would I know whether you should do this or... No teacher, no one knows that. But inside oneself, one can begin to feel a sense of a direction as you explore the different motivating and inhibitors to the direction you would like to take, the fears that are back there that inhibit that energy from coming forward. As you begin to explore that, it becomes obvious what the next step needs to be. But whether we take it or not will be dependent upon how thoroughly we bring the light of our attention to bear upon the fear that we have in that instant. And doubting, the sense of self-doubt, masks that knowing, that intuitive knowing. We get thrown off away from the intuitive knowing into the pain of really not being sufficient. That trumps the knowing. The knowing is quieter. It doesn't have the reactivity pattern that the inadequacy does. But if you just quiet that down, if you're willing to go through the inadequacy, you can get a sense of what step needs to be taken. Now let's just look at these two forms, this sense of self-insulation and self-recrimination, for a moment. in self-insulation, the anger and the thrashing out, this thing, I can't do this, which is an unacceptable thought to have because it incriminates me. So instead of doing that, I insulate from myself from that, and then I say, oh, this isn't worth doing. So instead of it turning in about me, I can just say that the method doesn't work. This is all trash. And you can feel that having the task fail saves you. And it also leaves, of course, to a lot of judgment and of other traditions, and just a very angry and bitter state in which it's not working for you because for it to work, it has to show you what's driving your meditation. And what's driving your meditation is the doubt that you don't want to see, so it doesn't work. So then, since we stop it, we create its failure by our resistance to seeing what is true. As meditate, you don't do meditation. I tried that, it doesn't do a thing. And because the other people in the group quite likely have the same level of maturity, and oftentimes depending upon how the meditation is taught, there's a non-escape clause within it. And there's a non-escape clause in this one. You should be aware of that. The non-escape clause is that when you have a doubt, see it as doubt. It's a doubt. It's one of the hindrances. Oh, this is a doubt. The point is that sometimes there's an intuitive sense that you shouldn't meditate, or that you should be doing a different practice, or you should be doing a different strategy. That's an intuitive knowing that we have. But in order to keep you front and center within this method, we'll say, well, that's just a doubt. See it as a doubt and stay in this method. And well, that may not be, see, you can't get out of it. When I was a monk, you know, I knew I was going to be a monk for only a limited amount of time. And so when it came time for me to leave being a monk, all the other monks who wanted also to leave but felt, you know, were too rigid in their psyche to allow that possibility, they said, oh, you're just giving into doubt. How can you do that? How can you just go into doubt? You stay for a while and that doubt will disappear. And in myself, they could say that for as long as they wanted to, but in myself, I knew that it was the next step. I had satisfied that particular form of practice, and that the next step laid outside of that. And so I just took it, but it was I had to pass through the non-escape clause to get out of it. See? So be aware of non-escape clauses. They try to hold the population at bay. And of course, there's a positive, there's a value to that, and that it does temper the random thoughts we have about leaving. Right on retreat, those of you who've done retreat, I'm sure in the first couple of days, no matter how many retreats you've done, you think I should leave. Some of you have the maturity to know that that's just a blip on the screen, that too will pass. And so we say, see that as doubt. And then the blip will pass and then you can go on. But then there are some people who should leave. And hopefully the teacher has a way of being able to bring that out of the student. But to be aware of that, because I think it's really important that we don't give away our ability to make decisions for ourselves. In fact, that's a Krishnamurti quote that saved me one time when I was getting involved in a very shadowy scene. And I thought, you know what? I don't have this scene asked me to give away my ability to decide, make decisions for myself. I'm out of here. So if you see, it's a very funny thing. Very funny thing. Are you leaving because of your ignorance? Or are you leaving because you intuitively sense that that's the right thing for you to do? That's a very subtle question and one that can be manipulated, especially when you're being screamed at by everyone who's you're accessing their doubt for them. So we have come here to see if the Buddhist truths are relevant to us, not to be saved by Buddhism. And the way is discovered by each of us over time. We each have to rediscover our way. Now, in self-recrimination, because we implode with our doubt, we just feel awful. We think, you know, awakening becomes an ideal. We think, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. It's an ideal. And I have this huge distance to cross between this lowly person called me and the ideal of what I have to be in order to be awakened. And you know what we just created? We just created God. Where do you think he or she comes from? God couldn't be in this. And we can see that the love of God in that sense is really the absence of self-love, isn't it? This is sobering. You can see much of the culture laid out in front of you here. And we have to be strong enough to pick up the pieces, not to go by just what people say we should do. And so this sense of almost doing penance for the miserable person I am, I have to work hard, I have to, this is, you know, it's got to be almost, it's got to be so difficult that I can overcome the sense of my self-loathing, that I can counterweight the loathing I have by the hard work I do. So we make spirituality not the simplest thing. Not the simplest thing, which it is. But we fill it with the self-recrimination of our life. Instead of just looking at the pain, instead of just saying, okay, I doubt. If I'm the only one in the room, so that's it. That's it. Let me look at this. Expose my doubt to the light of inward truth. And that's its secret. That's the way out, because as soon as we see it directly, we see the doubt directly, not through the assumption of our history. The assumption of our history convinces us that, rightly so, we are miserable. A miserable person. Because you can prove it. My mother said this and this and this about me, and I have the facts. It's all there. My teacher, I failed. This happened. You know, you got it all there. You got it listed. Through your history, each one of you are rightfully miserable. Okay? But that's not the way we look in awareness. That's not the way we look in true spiritual orientation. We look at it from now, from the self-talk of now. Now we've opened up the space between the logs. Now the fire is burning, but there's space around the logs, which allows us to know that the history is just a conditioned attitude. And in the present, because I can feel it in the present, what's conditioning except an urge to go forward in the same way we've always been? But all I have to do is hold that urge, feel it within the space that I'm giving it, and it's just an urge. And I can act any way I want to because there's complete freedom within that space. So here's the key point. Now I feel unworthy, but I sit up straight, I look somebody in the eye, I square my shoulders, I speak to them, I let my actions from body be completely counter to the way my attitudinal basis seems to be indicating, all my doubt. I don't give it over to it. I don't allow myself to hunch my shoulders, bow my head in self-disgrace, cast my eyes downward. I take my seat on the earth. I touch the earth. And mind, do what you will. I don't care, because I'm here. And if I'm here, you're just a dumping center of the past. You're just, okay, so dump. In presence, in awareness. I can feel this. And I'm also in the right spot. And now, what distance do I have to cross for this spiritual awakening? How far is it from me? How distant is that ideal God of mine? How far away am I from the healing of this pain? And this can be done. This is not just spiritual convenience, New Age speak, but we get our fingernails dirty in this stuff. We're like gardeners, right? You dig in the ground with your bare fingers. And you're pulling the weeds through the actual experience of life. Enough of this fiction of self. Enough of this fiction of my assumptions about me. This is reality, or it doesn't have anything to say to me at all. Okay, all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So how do you sit? As an extension of the earth? Or a fluttering leaf on the tree? Where should you be if you weren't here? Where would you rather be? Where could you be? And where are you? No apologies here. We don't have time for the excuses of our life. Why I'm such a wretched person. Don't do that to yourself. Look from now and see how wretched you really are. All you ever do is feel the feeling, the emotion of wretchedness. You'll hear the assumption of a long ago small child who assumed that posture to life. And it's over. Okay, so if there's any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to. Yes?
Maybe a combination of both.
Say again?
Maybe a combination of both of those things.
Say what you mean by a combination of both.
A combination of both types of fear.
Of fear?
The
self-recrimination and self, you have both two types going on?
Or one, I'm asking.
Usually, no. If the defenses are set so that you do not want to feel the pain, if you want to insulate yourself from the pain, whenever the pain arises, you'll find a reason to cast your blame externally, right? The other way if you're self-recriminating and you feel pain, you'll find a way to blame yourself. It's poor me, it's me, oh, I did it again. It's constant, living in a constant state of shame, a constant state of apology. It's always thinking that you have been the fault, even if, you know, if somebody runs into you and you're dead stop, it's your fault that the traffic accident occurred. There's always a turning there. You know, no matter, a neutral incident can never happen. It has to be your fault. And so you'll find that one predominates as a theme in your life, right? And so it doesn't matter whether you go outward or inward. It's just as treacherous in either way. And it's just a way that the ego is satisfying itself through an image. The image of being, you know, always the victim, you know, so that you're always thrashing out at what life is doing to you. You get angry, you get cynical, despairing, all of that. That's an image. Or the sense of I'm just the shame of my life and how awful it's been, and that's an image. Either way, the ego thrives. It doesn't care whether you feel good about yourself. It just wants you to feel yourself. So you're not going to satisfy this by changing your images. You're not going to satisfy this, although it can take off a lot of the boiling pot, by just beginning to like yourself. Liking yourself is another image. Liking yourself gets you to the place where you're even willing to look at yourself. It gets you to the place where you're willing to look at yourself. Not liking yourself is so painful that you don't want any part of looking at yourself. That's why we encourage liking yourself. Not because it's spiritually better, but because you won't see anything when you don't look like yourself. You don't want to look. It feels better, I want to say that, so if you'd like to feel better, then like yourself. And I don't mean that, I mean it's better than not liking yourself in the sense that you'll be a better partner and all of that. But in terms of coming to the spiritual realization, what I'm really talking about is at the heart of this thing. One image, another image, it really, it's all the same. Yes. Okay, so there is a way that's called the great doubt, but that doesn't come from, it's not generated from self-pain. It comes when you're sufficiently mature that you can ask questions about the conditioning you have and wonder whether it's true or not. Like the question, who am I, comes from spiritual maturity. It's not a painful question at some point to ask, who am I? It's a doubting question that I've taken what I've been as a mistake. It's not the whole truth. And so that kind of doubt at some point holds a clarity of focus and draws you in to the questioning of life. And I think that's where you're pointing in your question, right? But that the difference is that it's not being... It's not the motivation from that isn't a poor image, and that's key. Yes, sir.
I was thinking in terms of the one you're casting down inside, the other
yes.
Casting. It seems like in relationships sometimes that you're paired up opposites.
Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
That's really the doubt, right?
It can be. The question is that this self-insulation and self-recrimination, oftentimes you find yourself coupled with the opposite for clear reasons that psychologically, you know, if I can dump on you, and you'll accept that dumping. The relationship works really well. Problem is when you no longer accept it, then I have to deal with, you see, it's usually the person who's at the end of the dumping that sets the limit and says, you know, I've had enough of this. The dumper, well, as long as you're accepting it, there's why would I ever want to change? Because it satisfies my need to get out of my own pain by you accepting the being the cause of everything that's troubling to me. Isn't that interesting? And so I'm not saying that all relationships have that as their main fixture, but we do find that, we often find a compatibility within the alternative frames of strategies that we use. And just to look at that, and that's why I think couples in general, you know, especially as they're growing, go through enormous stretching themselves. Because whatever it is that you've agreed on in your partnership becomes exposed. Whatever those strategies, those unbalanced strategies are, they'll become exposed at some point just in your desire to flush out all the painful areas. And that then challenges the balance that the relationship has attained through the difficult images that each person owns. Once those difficult images are perceived, then the relationship is no longer in balance. And then you have to find a new balance as the strategies are exposed. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for saying that the spiritual work is the hardest work we'll ever do, because it is, and it's work, and it's nice to know we're all in it together. But how do I continue to keep the work from not becoming a battle? Because sometimes I feel like it is the ego, I feel like the ego fights for me. And rather than wrestling myself back from it, I don't want to do that, but I want to do, it's hard work.
When you say the ego fights for you, what do you mean by that? And don't put yourself out, say I. Don't put, say the ego does, say yeah.
I fight for lack of awareness.
You fight for lack of awareness? Mm-hmm. You fight for lack of awareness.
And lack of presence and lack of...
You fight for it? Yeah. Okay, so remember that the Buddha talked about this practice ending suffering. Okay. So anytime you're in a struggle, anytime you're framing what you're doing as being in a struggle, you really need to look at what you're really doing. Oftentimes we're at odds with the principle or direction that the practice is really meant to take. And we think we're going in a wise direction, but actually what we're doing is fostering further suffering, further tension within us. And there's nothing that's more true than that, than how we try to awaken ourselves. Because the tension of us trying to wake up is the attention of the unconscious, is the tension of the unconscious trying to be conscious. Now, how can the unconscious decide that it wants to be conscious until it makes itself conscious? You see, being mindful, when you are here, you are the embodiment of the unconscious, the sense of I, or you would know what you were. If you don't know what you are, then you can be assured that the sense of I is unconscious. Okay? That's the definition of what unconscious is. I don't know what it is. Or I'm assuming it's one thing and it's really another. So if you're assuming that you have an ego that's in place, then you're as yet unconscious to it. So how can the sense of unconsciousness effort its way towards conscious? It doesn't even know what it's doing. It doesn't know what direction it's taking. It doesn't even know what it means to be conscious, because it's the embodiment of the unconscious. Okay, so then now I'm completely helpless. I don't know what to do. I just see that I've been spinning around, around, and around in this thing. So I listen to the instructions all over again. And I hear, relax. Oh, I hear, I hear, release the tension. I hear non-judgment. Lo and behold, the fundamentals of the practice, which I think many of us try to move on, it's like, I have the fundamentals down. What's the higher teaching? The higher teaching is to go back to the fundamentals. What's non-judgment look like? What does relaxation look like? What does release of tension, why do we encourage this? It's because when you're in that state of tensionless living, there is awareness. When I'm in a state of tensionful living, trying to make myself aware, that's another tension on my tensions that I already have. And my awareness looks like a pinhole that I'm clawing at the pinhole to widen it, but it just, instead of this is, okay, let me just see here. Let's just do this together. It's best in a group. We can use each other's energy to come to a, I mean, let's just see. I'm not interested in fooling myself, but I'm not interested in going the other way either. So what's it look like when I just relax? So let's just relax here together. Don't try to be aware, try to be relaxed. Release the tension. If there's no trying in relaxation really, there's just a release of tension. And you'll see that the more relaxed and tensionless you become, the more present you are. I don't understand why we don't get that. Do you think that's some kind of magic trick? It's just a simple equation. Relaxation and the release of resistance, the more awareness. The more effort, the less awareness. I'm beginning to get this thing. So when you're like this, then what you need to do is move in the correct orientation, correct alignment, and move, and you'll move forward. You'll see it right in front of you. Thereby, it will be a direct experience of your own wakefulness. You'll have that directly. It won't be just, you hear an instruction and then you try to convert that instruction into your efforts and into your striving and into your ambition. You hear it and you really take it in and you begin to see from your own experience what these instructions have to do about your experience as you're experiencing it. Okay, all. Thank you for your attention this evening.